From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson in California. It's Here and Now. I'm here at NPR West. And right here in California right now, voters are voting in the primary, along with voters in five other states. Obviously, we know who the Republican nominee is going to be. And as of last night, according to the AP, Hillary Clinton is the presumptive Democratic nominee, having secured enough delegates and superdelegates. House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi endorsed Clinton this morning. Here she is on ABC's Good Morning America.
Well, I'm a voter in California, and I have voted for Hillary Clinton for President of the United States and proud to endorse her for that position.
But Senator Bernie Sanders is not giving up yet. We'll hear more from where I am in California, the biggest prize today. But right now, let's check in with another state that's holding a primary today, and that would be New Jersey. Matt Katz is a political reporter at New Jersey Public Radio. Matt, what are the polls saying there?
Looks like both Trump on the Republican side and Hillary Clinton on the Democratic side will win this thing. Not that it necessarily matters. New Jersey was expecting to have a role in this race, but it looks like it'll be decided without much of New Jersey's help. John Kasich and Ted Cruz on the Republican side, both of whom dropped out of the race, are still on the ballot. So it's possible some Republicans come out just to register their disdain for Trump and vote for these other guys, because they do have that opportunity.
But I have to say, here in California, I've been talking to people. There are a lot of people out there who are still going to vote for Bernie Sanders, even though, as we said, the AP says Hillary Clinton is already the presumptive nominee. What about in New Jersey? Does Sanders have a lot of support there?
He has some. I've actually heard from both sides, people who are really passionate about Hillary Clinton, who are going to vote today regardless, and for Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders has been targeting independents in the state of New Jersey, and that's because independent voters can show up to the polls today and say they're a Republican or a Democrat and register on the spot and participate in either primary. So it is certainly possible Bernie Sanders is able to pull some independents over to his side today and act as a little bit of a spoiler for Hillary, but pollsters do not expect him to be able to win this thing here.
I have to ask you, because you are the guy who has covered Chris Christie for so long. He, of course, famously early on endorsed Donald Trump for the nomination on the Republican side. What kind of role has he been playing in New Jersey as the governor of New Jersey in the Trump campaign? Because we haven't really seen him in a while.
Yeah, well, he's got like three roles. First role, I call it Trump-splaining. That's when he is asked questions about some incendiary remark that Trump makes, and he explains it. So he downplays any reaction to something Trump said, or he tries to moderate the comment. Today, he actually was voting, and there were a bunch of reporters who bombarded him at the polling place to ask about Trump's most recent comments about the heritage of a judge, the Mexican heritage of the judge right on the Trump University case. And he said Trump is not a racist and he's not going to analyze and give feedback on everything Trump says, but the media is overplaying it and making a big deal about it. So he really tries to moderate Trump's image, but he's also an advisor to Trump. They talk almost every day, and he's playing this behind the scenes role where he links Trump to donors and members of the Republican establishment whom Trump really needs down the stretch of the campaign. Christie is very much of the GOP establishment, so he plays an important role for Trump in that regard. And he also has a formal role in the campaign. His title is transition chairman. He's in charge of vetting people who could be in a Trump White House.
Yesterday, we spoke with a reporter in Montana. They're voting today as well. And he said that these East Coast politicians are not connecting with the voters there. I have to ask you, because the three candidates who are left in the race all have some connection to New York. Are they connecting with the voters of New Jersey?
They're very much of New York. I mean, Trump is he's a media mogul. He lives down the block from all the major cable news studios in Manhattan. But yet he plays a more populist role. He's not running as a New Yorker. He's running as a blue collar worker in the Midwest. So it's an interesting dynamic there.
Trump as a blue collar worker in the Midwest. I mean, I like that. Yeah,
it's odd. It's an odd thing, right? But I mean, that's sort of the demographic he's playing to. Not to the moneyed elite on the coasts.
Matt Katz, political reporter with New Jersey Public Radio. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
Well, this week we're remembering Muhammad Ali ahead of the celebration of his life on Friday. Today, his conversion to Islam. Born Cassius Clay, he decided to throw off his grandfather's slave name in 1964 after meeting Malcolm X. That powered much of his life to come. Zahir Ali is a researcher and lecturer in American history focusing on Islam and Black America. Zahir, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you know, and others have noted how extraordinary this was, that this was the first African-American to achieve global celebrity through the Olympic gold medal in 1960, the Sonny Liston World Championship boxing win in 64, and then to take that celebrity and turn it into this religious activism. Just remind us, how stunning was this in 64?
Well, it was quite stunning for several reasons. The primary one being that Cassius Clay at the time, when he embraced the Nation of Islam, it was not, you know, by any means a popular faith, certainly in the United States. It had a stigma attached to it because of the Black nationalist politics that the community practiced. And so this was not a popular move as far as broader America was concerned.
Yes, Malcolm X and the Nation of Islam were viewed as militants, as vocal separatists, as sort of the other end of the spectrum from Martin Luther King, which, of course, you know, history has softened that view. They were born
right.
of a vicious, segregated America. But it wasn't the broader Islam world.
No, it wasn't. Yeah. It wasn't. This was a very unique expression of Islam that emerged in the United States out of, you know, a very racist context. And so the kind of Islam that was practiced by the Nation of Islam spoke directly to the conditions of African Americans. That said, when Elijah Muhammad gave Cassius Clay his name, Muhammad Ali, that was a kind of global passport. And so it wasn't that he had achieved global celebrity and then he became, you know, joined the Nation of Islam and this somehow threatened to undermine his global celebrity. It actually enhanced his global celebrity because people around the world, especially in Asia and Africa and the Caribbean who are Muslim, they didn't really know or care about the theological nuances between the Nation of Islam and other traditions of Islam. They just heard that there was a man named Muhammad Ali, the two most popular names in the Muslim world, who was the heavyweight champion. And yeah. So this kind of gave him a kind of passport to, and people were like, oh, we have a Muslim heavyweight champion. And that was, that enhanced his global celebrity.
Well, and it's interesting because he was also scorned for not using his name. Wesley Morris in the New York Times had a great line this week, and he wrote, Ali was scorned, but then later in 1974, I think, when Roots came out, and the main figure there, Kunta Kinte, was whipped for not using his slave name. A lot of America went, oh, I get it now. I get what Muhammad Ali was doing. But talk about how he left the Nation of Islam. He joined the broader Islamic community. To what effect?
If his joining the Nation of Islam in 1964 enhanced his global appeal, then his kind of joining the kind of global Muslim tradition did even more so. It enhanced his global appeal. It enhanced his appeal, of course, in the United States, because now he had kind of moved away from what people had considered was a separatist vision. And so this only increased his appeal. Yeah.
And we can't forget in 1966, Muhammad Ali cited his Muslim faith in applying for conscientious objector status during the Vietnam War. He took the case all the way to the Supreme Court and won. Some say it made him the most prominent person in the world to have taken on the U.S. government and won. He lost years of his life.
Yeah, so I think Muhammad Ali's actions in the 1960s really require close attention because these are the actions that I think has made him the hero that he is for many people. Standing up against the Vietnam War, risking and in fact losing his right to fight because of his opposition to the war, his conscientious objection. And so I think it's important for us to think about what shaped his ideas in the 1960s and his emergence as an icon of Black power. I mean, here was a Black man saying, I am Black and I am the greatest, mm-hmm. at a time when African Americans were recovering from, you know, the kind of stereotyping that denigrated them throughout the media.
So Zahir Ali, you are 43 now. You've told us that even though you share the last name, of course you're not related, but when you were little, you'd be asked if you were. And what would you say?
I would smile a wide smile and say yes. And, you know, it's funny, even more recently, I live in New York, and I was at an event with all of these, like, New York literati, and this older woman came up to me after I gave a presentation, and she said, you know, are you related to Muhammad Ali? And I was so shocked by that question. I hadn't been asked that in years. But I looked at her and I saw that she was from a different generation and from a different community. And I just smiled and said, in faith, in faith.
And what does that mean to you, just, you know, as a young kid coming up, that there was this almost Superman that looked like you, that, you know, had the same faith? What did that mean?
Oh, it was so affirming to see that there was somebody that reflected me in that way, and in such a way, to know that there was a champion, a sports hero, and as I got older, a strong political figure that I could connect with.
That's Zaheer Ali, researcher, lecturer in American history with a focus on Islam and Black America. He's also oral historian at the Brooklyn Historical Society. Zaheer, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Californians are voting in the primaries along with voters in five other states. Yesterday, we heard from comedian Bill Maher, who has endorsed Bernie Sanders. You can hear that interview at hereandnow.org. Right now, let's bring in former California Governor Gray Davis, who is supporting Hillary Clinton. Welcome.
It's my pleasure, Jeremy. Nice to be with you.
So you've endorsed Hillary Clinton in this primary. Why?
I have, because I think she's the best person running for office to lead this country and lead the free world. I mean, as Secretary of State, a former senator, First Lady of the United States, she's been a part of change when she was not even in public office, and a part of change as a U.S. senator working with both sides of the aisle, something we desperately need going forward. And obviously, she has the respect of world leaders given her tenure as Secretary of State. So I can't remember a more qualified person running for president in the last 30 years.
So why do you think so many of your fellow Democrats are not thinking the same things that you're thinking and would actually prefer Bernie Sanders to be the nominee?
I think Bernie's run a good campaign. Hats off to him. Generated a lot of enthusiasm. You know, Democrats are always looking for a new candidate, and I think Bernie fits the bill. But the bottom line is Hillary has won 3 million more votes. I'm certain she will be the nominee, and I'm certain she'll be the next president of the United States.
But as you know, there are some polls that have shown this is a very close race. Bernie Sanders could well win the California primary. Would that be a serious blow to the Clinton campaign, do you think, if that happens?
Well, it would be nice to win. It would be the punctuation point on this or exclamation point rather on this campaign, generate momentum going into the convention. But if it doesn't win, the reality on the ground stays the same. All of us look forward to working with Bernie Sanders and his dedicated team and his millions of followers, because we all agree on one thing: Donald Trump should not be the next president.
Well, do you think that Bernie Sanders should drop out of the race after the California primary?
No, I'm not going to make decisions for Bernie Sanders. I'm sure he exceeded his expectations. He certainly exceeded the expectations of the pundits. He's, you know, got a lot of people enthusiastic and coming out to vote. That's a great thing for the for him, but also a great thing for the party. And just as those of us who supported Hillary in 2008, you know, fell into line and were happy to be a part of the effort to elect President Obama, I expect virtually all of the Sanders voters will eventually come on board.
Are you concerned at all by some of the polls that show Clinton trailing Donald Trump in a general election?
No, for two reasons. You know, until he has the benefit of starting to consolidate his party, that hasn't happened yet in the Democratic Party and may not happen until we get to the convention. But the good news is the conventions are a month earlier this time, so you'll have like 90 days to put the party back together. And again, going back to my support for Hillary in 2008, you know, there were a lot of wounded feelings. We didn't feel terrific the day after she pulled out. But over time, we got on board. We got enthusiastic about President Obama, one of the best speakers in American history. And he did a wonderful job as President of the United States for 8 years. So I'm optimistic and expect that virtually all the Sanders voters will get behind Hillary.
As many of our listeners know, you faced a recall election as governor of California back in 2003, and Arnold Schwarzenegger, Republican, was put into office after that. Do you see any parallels between Schwarzenegger and Trump, two entertainers who have become politicians and have been, at least so far, pretty successful?
Well, you can't discount the importance of celebrity, but they're two entirely different personalities. I mean, Schwarzenegger's politics were actually quite close to mine. He asked me several times after I left office to assist him on various initiatives that he was for or against, and it was easy for me to say yes because I felt the same way he did on those initiatives. So whether it was the environment or public safety or public health, we bonded together. Obviously, I can't see myself doing that with Donald Trump. So Donald Trump is moving in a totally different direction. And while they're both celebrities, the American people realize this is a big choice. It's like one candidate is heading north and the other candidate is heading south.
That's former Governor Gray Davis of California. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Good to be with you.
And now let's hear from a Republican. Assemblyman Rocky Chavez is a former Marine colonel who's been in the California legislature since 2012, representing an area near San Diego. Colonel Chavez, welcome. And you're not endorsing Donald Trump. Why not?
I have been listening to Mr. Trump for some time now, and his comments on veterans, in particular with McCain, with POWs, his comments about when he first announced portraying Mexicans as rapists, his comments on trade negotiations in the Pacific and saying we're losing our shirts and our jobs, and his comments on women. And every time he portrays himself, it's about him, and he likes to vilify everyone. And that's not the sort of leader that we need in the United States.
So what do you think of some of your fellow Republicans who have gotten behind him?
I think everybody has their own choice and their own experience to do it. Having been a Marine colonel for 28 years in the Marine Corps, and having taken an oath to this country and known what the oath is about supporting, defending the Constitution, having been a local elected member for two terms, and then having been the Undersecretary of the California Department of Veteran Affairs, responsible for taking care of the 2.2 million veterans in the state. I'm a little older, and I come with a different perspective than a lot of probably younger Republicans.
Well, why do you think that Trump has gotten, at this point, so much support from members of your party across the country?
I think a lot of people just want to win the race. And a lot of people, Republicans, you know, share my same concern about Hillary Clinton. You know, I would never vote for Hillary. She's duplicitous. And so that's their driving force about winning. But as I was telling a Republican over the weekend, I said, sometimes when you're in a group, let's say like a sports team, and everybody just wants to do this because this is what the team's doing, the leader stands up and says, no, this is wrong. And that's why I'm standing up and saying to everyone, this is the wrong way to go.
Do you think that he's going to win in November?
I'm fearful that he will be.
More fearful than if Hillary Clinton becomes the president?
I think Donald Trump, his comments on nuclear weapons, which is a serious, serious thing, his idea of redefining NATO, his view of Russia, which actually is one of the greatest threats you see in the Middle East, and Putin is no small-time actor. Those are really serious things, and I fear that Trump could cause great harm to this country.
One of the big issues that he's been running on is immigration. He wants to build a wall and have Mexico pay for it. He also wants to deport all of the people who are in this country illegally. What do you think is a reasonable immigration policy for a Republican to have in 2016? What do you think would work?
Well, I've been pushing forward since 2012 on immigration reform. I think a reasonable law would be to recognize who's here and call them residents, so get them out of the shadows, allow them to pay taxes, allow them to drive cars, don't cause fear within their families. I think that's extremely important. As I tell a lot of my Republican friends, I could never be part of an organization that would take a mother or father away from their child. So when Mr. Trump is talking about deporting people, men and women, whose children are born here, breaking up families is not something that I'd be supportive of. And as far as his issue about telling Mexico they're going to pay for this wall and they're going to even like it, and his little comment saying, oh, the wall is 10 feet taller, Mexico is our third largest trading partner to the United States. In California, it's our number one trading partner. And the reason we have the quality of life we have right now is a lot of good things have come out of NAFTA. I know a lot of times people portray, especially Mr. Trump or Mr. Sanders, portray this country being divided. Both of them, Sanders and Trump, use this scapegoat mentality where they blame somebody else, either the 1% or the Mexicans, for their economic situation. You know, we live in a very rich country. I never hear Sanders or Trump ever talking about what's great about this country. They always talk about how we're getting our lunch eaten by somebody else, and that's just not true.
Are you worried about running on a ticket that has Donald Trump at the top of it? And you were, by the way, in the Senate race in California, and then you decided to withdraw.
And part of that, the decision process we made was Trump, because as I went around the state of California, there's a lot of people that liked me because I'm my background as a Marine, my background as somebody who worked in the fields and worked his way through college. But as I continued on my race, I really picked up a very angry voice in the state. And as Trump and Sanders continued to beat their message of scapegoats, my team looked at it and said, this is not the time to be running the state of California as a Republican.
Hmm. So do you think the Democrat, whoever it is, will end up being the next senator from California?
Oh, I know it. In the top two, it'll be a Democrat versus a Democrat.
Well, Assemblyman Rocky Chavez, Colonel Chavez, who serves in the California State Assembly, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And by the way, we reached out to a number of California politicians who are supporting Donald Trump, including Congressman Daryl Issa, Congressman Duncan Hunter, and Assemblymember Melissa Melendez. None agreed to an interview. You're listening to Here and Now.
New York's Inspector General is out with a scathing report finding that widespread security lapses and breakdowns in oversight allowed those two convicted murderers to dig their way out of the maximum security prison in Dannemora last summer. Brian Mann with Here and Now contributor North Country Public Radio reports.
Northern New York is usually a playground this time of year, with tourists camping on mountain lakes and rental cabins packed with people escaping the cities. But last June, the region was locked down for 23 terrifying days with tense checkpoints manned by heavily armed guards.
Still looking for both of them? If you see them or think you've seen them, contact state police immediately.
More than 1,300 local, state, and federal officers were hunting for Richard Matt and David Sweat, two convicted killers who had dug their way out of Clinton Dannemora prison. It became clear in the days after their escape that something had gone seriously wrong inside one of America's toughest prisons. And in a long-awaited report issued yesterday on the one-year anniversary of the prison break, New York Inspector General Catherine Leahy Scott described widespread incompetence and mismanagement and what she portrayed as a complete breakdown in oversight.
The extent of complacency and failure to adhere to the most basic security standards uncovered by my investigation was egregious and inexcusable.
The report describes a maximum security facility where basic security had unraveled. Metal detectors weren't used regularly. Bags weren't checked at gates. Corrections officers allegedly neglected basic duties and discipline and even described themselves as lazy. Already, at least a dozen guards and administrators have been placed on leave or have resigned. One veteran corrections officer and a civilian worker are behind bars for aiding the escape. Leahy Scott says her probe uncovered even more criminal activity.
I have identified a number of DOCS employees who have committed criminal acts and violated DOCS policies and procedures.
In addition to portraying guards at Clinton Dannemora prison as almost comically inept, the report points out that many of them refused to cooperate with the investigation. Leahy Scott also raised troubling questions about whether the state prison system is capable of providing oversight and proper management of its own facilities, questions that point directly at the leadership of Acting Corrections Commissioner Anthony Annucci and Governor Andrew Cuomo. Speaking last July, right after the manhunt ended, Governor Cuomo said that for the time being, he was keeping Commissioner Annucci in his post.
Let's get the investigation done. Let's see what they say.
But others have suggested for months that a shakeup of New York's prisons is long overdue. Manhattan Assemblyman Daniel O'Donnell chairs the Corrections Committee in the state legislature. He held a hearing on the Dannemora escape last December.
Aside from the millions of dollars of cost to the state of New York, it also led to the terrorizing of the community where that prison was located. And let me be very clear, that is simply unacceptable.
At the time, O'Donnell asked whether a new kind of outside oversight, or ombudsman, is needed to monitor how New York's prisons are run.
Is the oversight model we have efficient and effective? Or are there other potential models that might exist?
This new report suggests that new oversight is needed. Inspector General Scott points in particular to allegations that some inmates at Clinton Dannemora Prison were beaten and threatened with torture by corrections officers following the escape. In the end, inmate Richard Matt was shot and killed. His partner, David Sweat, was shot and recaptured and is now serving time in solitary confinement. The aftershocks of their escape continue in New York's prisons. For Here and Now, I'm Brian Mann.
We're broadcasting from California today, where voting is underway in the state's presidential primary. It's the biggest prize left on the calendar before the nominating conventions next month. California is, of course, home to Silicon Valley, and many there are hoping to flex their political muscle this year. Here and Now's Peter O'Dowd reports.
Don't think for a second that the high flyers in tech aren't paying close attention to this election.
I hear fearful voices calling for building walls and distancing people they label as others.
Facebook chief Mark Zuckerberg blasted Donald Trump's policies without using the candidate's name.
For blocking free expression, for slowing immigration, reducing trade, and in some cases around the world, even cutting access to the internet.
And there's no Trump love from Meg Whitman either. The Hewlett-Packard Enterprise CEO was the Republican nominee for California governor in 2010. She dressed down the presumptive presidential nominee on CNBC.
I just don't think he is the right person to be president of the United States. And I think his policies around free trade will be damaging to business as a whole.
He is a great businessman.
I think the jury's out on that.
But there's also a streak of libertarianism in Silicon Valley. Take Peter Thiel, the PayPal co-founder and the man who helped fund Hulk Hogan's lawsuit against Gawker, is going to the Republican convention as a Trump delegate. Here he is on Bloomberg TV.
You know, the Trump-Sanders phenomena suggests that I think voters are angry, and of course, maybe they have some good things to be angry about, that we have trade policies, immigration policies, a corrupt government that doesn't quite do what it's supposed to, and a political class that's been very disconnected.
Now, the head of another Silicon Valley startup has made a business of all this interest in politics.
It's Steve Hilton here. I'm the co-founder and CEO of CrowdPack.
CrowdPack helps facilitate small individual donations to all sorts of political campaigns.
That's what we do.
Hilton's also got a mountain of data that shows where all these deep-pocketed CEOs, software designers, and engineers are spending their money this election season.
The winner in the tech sector so far in the 2016 race is...
Cue the drum roll.
Bernie Sanders, by quite a long way.
According to CrowdPack, Sanders has raked in more than $6 million from the tech sector. That more than doubles Hillary Clinton's haul. Hilton says the Sanders appeal makes sense. Not only does Silicon Valley skew far to the left politically, it also loves a disruptive force.
That has an appeal to people who think in very anti-establishment ways within their professional lives about how they can take the existing ways of doing things and turn them on their head and disrupt them. That is very much the culture of Silicon Valley.
But what about Donald Trump? Because his donation numbers are almost as shocking as Bernie Sanders.
If you look at Donald Trump, who in many ways you could imagine might have some appeal to the disruptive tendencies in Silicon Valley, his appeal is pretty close to zero.
And if you have to ask why...
Boycott Apple!
Trump has put tech in his crosshairs. He went after Apple CEO Tim Cook when the company refused the federal government's request to unlock an iPhone that belonged to the suspect in the San Bernardino terror attack.
Tim Cook is looking to do a big number, probably to show how liberal he is.
He didn't stop there. Trump's restrictive stance on immigration is alienating to an industry that relies on workers from other countries. And you might remember Trump's plan to combat the Islamic State by controlling the use of the internet.
We have to talk to them, maybe in certain areas, closing that internet up in some way. Somebody will say, oh, freedom of speech, freedom of speech. These are foolish people.
In return, tech workers have given Donald Trump all of $16,420 since his campaign began, according to CrowdPack. Compare that to Mitt Romney, who pulled in more than $8 million from the sector in 2012. So what does all this mean for Hillary Clinton? who as of today is the Democrats' presumptive nominee.
I suspect they will come out in droves, not so much because they like Clinton, but because Trump is everything they hate.
Greg Ferenstein wrote a book called The Age of Optimists about politics in Silicon Valley. He says in some ways, Clinton is also at odds with tech workers. She's not a big fan of charter schools. Silicon Valley is. Both she and Bernie Sanders are out of line with many tech companies' positions on free trade. But at the end of the day, Ferenstein thinks Silicon Valley will get over that.
They're not fans of government as a regulator, but they want large government spending. They want it on education and research and outreach to immigrants and anything which makes people the best versions of themselves and allows the smartest people to contribute the most.
And if Silicon Valley is a fan of big government, chances are its money will back the Democrats in November. For Here and Now, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
Well, joining us now for more on this is Recode's Don Chmielewski, part of our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. And Don is with me here in the studio in Culver City today. Hi, Don.
Hey.
So you heard that. My takeaway is they love Bernie, they don't like Trump, and they're sort of lukewarm on Hillary Clinton.
That's dead on. You know, Hillary has deep roots in Silicon Valley. She and her husband, Bill Clinton, have been cultivating that region for quite some time, and she's been a frequent visitor throughout this election cycle. And yet, they still the community still hasn't embraced her as warmly as they did Obama back in 2008.
And the reason for that is?
She is just that's a fair question. I'm not entirely sure, but she just doesn't inspire the same degree of passion that, for example, we've seen with Bernie Sanders' campaign.
How much clout does Silicon Valley and its workers have this year, this time around in the political cycle?
So if we measure clout in terms of dollars, Silicon Valley is certainly a treasure trove. It is the engine of our economy's growth, and it has been very influential, as you know, in the Obama administration for the last since 2008. Yeah. So Silicon Valley is used to influencing politics and is gradually recognizing the importance of having a relationship with Congress when it comes to issues like immigration reform or how it treats taxation. So the Valley is used to having a cozy relationship with the White House, and that may change in this election cycle.
Well, there are some high-level Silicon Valley people. We heard about Peter Thiel there, who has given millions to back Republican candidates, and he is allegedly going to be a Trump delegate at the convention. Oracle chairman Larry Ellison was a big supporter of Marco Rubio's super PAC. How many of these Silicon Valley big name Republicans are there?
There are a lot. Certainly, no shortage of billionaires in Silicon Valley. But people who are Republican voters, like for example Meg Whitman, have Hewlett-Packard's chairman has backed other candidates throughout the primary.
We heard her there that she does not like Trump.
Right. But, you know, so it remains to be seen whether she's going to align behind Hillary Clinton or maybe not even vote. I mean, so there are – Republicans are really torn over this issue of, do we vote for Trump's opponent to avoid him getting into office or do we vote a third party candidate?
And what about this issue that has – we've heard about so many times is such a big issue in Silicon Valley is immigration and the H-1B visas because they're bringing so many people in on these sort of high-tech, high-skill visas, the H-1Bs, and Donald Trump wants to make changes to that.
He absolutely does. And there's a clear distinction. If Bernie does not manage to overcome Hillary at the convention, as he's promising to – he's hoping to do, there's a really clear distinction there. Hillary Clinton has endorsed immigration reform. She hasn't spoken directly to the H-1B, that highly skilled visa issue, in this campaign cycle, though she did support it back in 2007-2008. But Trump is definitely has vowed repeatedly to crack down on that. He says that Silicon Valley should be forced to pay higher wages for these higher skilled positions, a position that he says will ultimately result in more Americans landing jobs. He feels that corporations are using H-1B visas as a way to lowball these engineering jobs.
Is that fair? As somebody who covers Silicon Valley, is that fair? Is that a fair
Well,
charge?
I mean, Trump would certainly know. He uses H-2B visas to staff his Mar-a-Lago in Florida. So he certainly knows the business proposition.
What about the areas where Silicon Valley would like the government to stay away from regulating? And I think of Uber. Uber has spent all this money all around the country trying to get places not to regulate them to the extent that the cities and the municipalities want to.
And that's a really fair question. So what's interesting here is that ends up being a state-by-state issue and not a federal issue. I mean, all the municipalities municipalities are regulating that. And so Uber and Lyft have both have devoted resources to fighting this battle kind of city by city and state by state. So it hasn't risen to the level of to a national debate level, although there is a larger issue of the sharing economy, which is really transforming the workplace. And neither candidate has really spoken at depth about this.
That's Don Chmielewski of Recode. Don, great to see you. Thank you so much.
Great to be here.
And we also want to thank our great hosts here at NPR West, Marcia Caldwell and Patrick Murray, who've been at the controls, and Angie Hamilton-Lowe also. Our coverage produced by Ethan Lindsay with help from Mary Dew, and our audio engineers, Paul Vikas and James Trout in Boston. Stay with us. More coming up.
During his visit to Vietnam, President Obama announced the American-backed Fulbright University Vietnam, the first independent college in the country, with former senator and Vietnam veteran Bob Kerry head of the board. And that launched a debate on Vietnam's social media about whether he should be. Kerry was a Navy SEAL who won a Bronze Star after a 1969 raid on a village said to kill 21 Viet Cong. But in 2001, Kerry told reporters investigating the incident that, in fact, elderly men, women, and children had been slaughtered. He did not agree with a member of his unit who said it was systematic. Kerry said it was more fog of war. But in a speech to ROTC cadets at the Virginia Military Institute, he said it was not a military victory. It was a tragedy, and I ordered it. How I have anguished ever since. Despite that, and another recent apology, there are Vietnamese who feel he should not be involved in the school, although the secretary of the party of Ho Chi Minh City said recently he should. Bob Kerry reportedly said he'd step down if his presence was disturbing, but as you'll hear, he does not want to look back. We spoke yesterday and began by asking about that raid in Vietnam.
Well, it was a night operation. There were armed men in that village. We went in there with the purpose of intercepting some Viet Cong who were operating in that area. And I think it is accurate to say that we used excessive force. But it's not like we walked in there a la My Lai and ordered a massacre.
No, in fact, you were looking for Viet Cong. And that's from correct. What we understand, instead you came across families.
Well, but there were families in every village where we were operating. I mean, the larger story here is that the United States tactics resulted in at least 1 million civilians being killed over the time that we were fighting that war. And there are many soldiers and sailors and airmen and Marines who went to Vietnam who had no such experience. But the hard facts are that there was a very large number of civilian casualties over the course of the war.
Well, and it is easy for those who didn't serve in this hellish war, the first in which the enemy did not wear uniforms. And you told 60 Minutes, Dan Rather, in 2001 about what seemed to be your fears that night about what to do with the people that you encountered who were women and children or the elderly. Let's listen.
Yeah, I don't have any doubt that that the people that we killed were at the very least sympathetic to the Viet Cong and at the very most were supporting their efforts to kill us.
Old men, women, and children?
The Viet Cong. In a guerrilla war, the people who get caught in the middle are the civilians, and the Viet Cong were 1,000% more ruthless.
You have said that this has haunted you.
Look, this has all been reported on at length, and I don't mind having a conversation about that, but this whole story began as a result of a 25-year effort to make peace with Vietnam, and part of it is this undergraduate program that we have a special permit to do. We have the full support. A recent statement by the secretary of the Communist Party in Ho Chi Minh City was an eloquent statement of essentially forgiveness, accepting my apology, and recognizing that it is going to produce a conversation, probably a healthier conversation in Vietnam than it does in the United States. But we're moving ahead. We hired a woman from Hanoi who remembers the Christmas bombing. She remembers the war very vividly. She's our first president. She's the one that will be running the program. We're helping Vietnam build its first truly independent college as a result of two long studies that we did for the Ministry of Education in the first decade of the 21st century.
And you have a lot of support in that. One person writes, I would welcome Bob Kerry. We should forgive him, not forget the deaths of innocents. Another said, give him a chance to correct his mistake by doing something useful. Is this effort partly about making up for that night in 1969?
No, look, in the United States, we keep focusing on the past. We're living in the past. Vietnam is living in the future.
Well, again, sir, the only reason this has come to anyone's attention is because of social media in Vietnam. They were also posting saying, your appointment is like sticking the criminal knife into the Vietnamese people's scar. Nobody was talking about it here. Look, you left part of a leg in Vietnam. Others did not have to go there. But what would you say to those who are worried about your appointment?
Look, I've never engaged in any political activity where there weren't critics. The harshest critics of the entire normalization process didn't come from Vietnam. They came from Americans who call me a traitor because I said there was no living POWs held in Vietnam. So you can't get involved in any political issues, but I'll repeat it. There's a healthier conversation going on about the war in Vietnam today than there is in the United States.
But am I misreading the news? I thought you had said that if this did become an issue, you would step down.
Yes, but it has not become. If this was an American university, maybe I would step down. But it's not. It's a Vietnamese university, and the secretary of the party for Ho Chi Minh City fully supports the effort. And my measurement is if I were to step down, it would hurt the project. It would make it much more difficult to be successful. So I choose to stay involved, in spite of the critics, in spite of the opening of the wounds. I've been involved with this since 1989. Mm-hmm. I was involved indirectly in the peace negotiations to end the war in Cambodia. I was involved in the writing of the roadmap of the first President Bush. I was involved with the writing of the legislation that Bill Clinton signed in 1995, in part because the United States and Vietnam do have a special relationship. Not because I have a special relationship, but because Vietnam and the United States has a special relationship, in no small measure because of the war. Mm-hmm. And I can choose to hide and not do anything, but I'm in a position where I can actually help. And I think at the end of the day, we'll build a really good undergraduate college led by the Vietnamese people.
Bob Kerry, former senator, governor, presidential candidate, Vietnam vet. Senator Kerry, thank you.
You're welcome.
And we'll follow the progress of the new school in Vietnam. Vietnam, 50 years ago, never over. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.